concentric swells of disturbed water raced away from it, sickening troughs that made the speeding boat pitch and slide. Naki slowed her boat, some instinct telling her that it was now largely futile to pursue Weir. Then she turned around so that she faced the node properly, and cautiously edged closer, ignoring the nausea she felt as the boat ducked and dived from crest to trough. The node, like all nodes, had always shown a rich surface topology, fused hummocks and tendrils, fabulous domes and minarets, and helter-skelters of organized biomass linked and entangled by a telegraphic system of draping aerial tendrils. In any instant it resembled a human city, or more properly, a fairy tale human city, that had been efficiently smothered in green moss. The bright moving motes of sprites dodged through the interstices, the portholes and arches of the urban mass. The metropolitan structure only hinted at the node's Byzantine interior architecture, and much of that could only be glimpsed or implied. But this node was like a city going insane. It was accelerating, running through cycles of urban renewal and redesign with indecent haste. Structures were evolving before Naki's eyes. She had seen change this rapid just before Mina was taken, but normally those kinds of changes happened too slowly to be seen at all, like the daily movement of shadows. The throbbing had decreased, but the flickering change was now throwing out a steady, warm, malodorous breeze. And when she stopped the boat, she dared come no closer now, Naki heard the node. It was like the whisper of a billion forest leaves presaging a summer storm. Whatever was happening here, it was about to become catastrophic. Some fundamental organization had been lost. The changes were happening too quickly, with too little central coordination. Tendrils thrashed like whips, unable to connect to anything. They flailed against each other. Structures were forming and collapsing. The node was fracturing, so that there were three, four, perhaps five distinct cores of flickering growth. As soon as she had the measure of it, the process shifted it all. Meager light flickered within the epileptic mass. Sprites swarmed in confused flight patterns, orbiting mindlessly between foci. The sound of the node had become a distant shriek. "It's dying," Naki breathed. Weir had done something to it. What, she couldn't guess. But this could not be a coincidence. The shrieking died down. The breeze ceased. The node had stopped its convulsions. She looked at it, hoping against hope that perhaps it had overcome whatever destabilizing influence Weir had introduced. The structures were still misshapen. There was still an impression of incoherence, but the city was inert. The cycling motion of the sprites slowed, and a few of them dropped down into the mass as if to roost. A calm had descended. Then Naki heard another sound. It was lower than anything she had heard before, almost subsonic. It sounded less like thunder than like a very distant, very heated conversation. It was coming from the approximate center of the node. She watched as a smooth green mound rose from the center of the node, resembling a flattened hemisphere. It grew larger by the second, assimilating the malformed structures with quiet indifference. They disappeared into the surface of the mound as if into a wall of fog, but they did not emerge again. The mound only increased its size, rumbling toward Naki. The entire mass of the node was changing into a single, undifferentiated mass. "Jota," she said. "We see it, Naki. We see it, but we don't understand it." "Weir must have used some kind of weapon against it," she said. "We don't know that he's harmed it. He might just have precipitated a change to a state we haven't documented." "That still makes it a weapon in my book. I'm scared, Jota."
"You think I'm not?"
Around her the sea was changing. She had forgotten about the submerged tendrils that connected the nodes. They were as thick as hawsers, and now they were writhing and thrashing just beneath the surface of the water. Green-tinged spume lifted into the air. It was as if unseen aquatic monsters were wrestling, locked in some dire-to-the-death contest. Naki, we are seeing changes in the closest of the two remaining nodes.
No, she said, as if denying it would make any difference.
I'm sorry.
Where is Weir?
We've lost him. There's too much surface disturbance. She realized then what had to be done. The thought arrived in her head with a crashing urgency.
Jota, you have to close the sea doors, now, immediately, before whatever Weir's unleashed has a chance to reach open ocean. That also happens to be Weir's only escape route.
Sivaraksa, to his credit, did not argue.
Yes, you're right, I'll start closure. But it will take quite a few minutes.
I know, Jota.
She cursed herself for not having thought of this sooner, and cursed Sivaraksa for the same error. But she could hardly blame either of them. Closure had never been something to take lightly. A few hours ago, it had been an event months in the future, an experiment to test the willingness of the jugglers to cooperate with human plans. Now it had turned into an emergency amputation, something to be done with brutal haste. She peered at the gap between the towers. At the very least, it would take several minutes for Sivaraksa to initiate closure. It was not simply a matter of pressing a button on his desk, but of rousing two or three specialist technicians who would have to be immediately convinced that this was not some elaborate hoax. And then the machinery would have to work. The mechanisms that forced the sea doors together had been tested numerous times, but the machinery had never been driven to its limit. The doors had never moved more than a few meters together. Now they would have to work perfectly, closing with watchmaker precision. And when had anything on Turquoise ever worked the first time? There, the tiniest, least perceptible narrowing of the gap. It was all happening with agonizing slowness. She looked back to what remained of the node. The mound had consumed all the biomass available to it and had now ceased its growth. It was as if a child had sculpted in clay some fantastically intricate model of a city, which a callous adult had then squashed into a single blank mass, erasing all trace of its former complexity. The closest of the remaining nodes was showing something of the same transformation, Naki saw. It was running through the frantic cycle that had presaged the emergence of the mound. She guessed now that the cycle had been the node's attempt to nullify whatever Weir had used against it, like a computer trying to reallocate resources to compensate for some crippling viral attack. She could do nothing for the jugglers now. Naki turned the boat around and headed back toward the cut. The sea doors had narrowed the gap by perhaps a quarter. The changes taking place within the moat had turned the water turbulent, even at the jetty. She hitched the boat to a mooring point and then took the elevator up the side of the wall, preferring to sprint the distance along the top rather than face the climb. By the time she reached the cut, the doors were three-quarters of the way to closure, and to Naki's immense relief, the machinery had yet to falter. She approached the tower. She had expected to see more people out on the top of the moat, even if she knew that Sivaraksa would still be in his control center. But no one was around. This was just beginning to register as a distinct wrongness when Sivaraksa emerged into daylight, stumbling from the door at the foot of the tower. For an instant she was on the point of calling his name. Then she realized that he was stumbling because he had been injured. His fingers were scarlet with blood, and that he was trying to get away from someone or something. Naki dropped to the ground behind a stack of construction slabs. Through gaps between the slabs, she observed Sivaraksa. He was swatting at something like a man being chased by a persistent wasp. Something tiny and silver harried him. More than one thing, in fact, a small swarm of them, streaming out the open door. Sivaraksa fell to his knees with a moan, brushing ineffectually at his tormentors. His face was turning red, smeared with his own blood. He slumped on one side. Naki remained frozen with fear. A person stepped from the open door. The figure was garbed in shades of fire. It was a Misha crane. For an absurd moment, Naki assumed that the woman was about to spring to Sivaraksa's assistance. It was something about her demeanor.
Naki found it hard to believe that someone so apparently serene could commit such a violent act. But Crane did not step closer to Sivaraksa.